this was a project which was the idea of the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse. There had been no real prevalence estimate in terms of how common disabilities were associated with mothers drinking alcohol during pregnancy in the United States. We had been doing population-based studies in other countries for, gosh, almost 20 years, particularly in Finland, in Italy, and in South Africa. But these kinds of studies had not been done in the United States before. So the previous estimates on how common disabilities are associated with maternal alcohol use were based on either small studies or they were based on clinic studies where children were referred in because of disabilities. So there was a bias toward children with specific problems in those studies. And so there really was no population-based estimate. The best way to do these types of studies is by doing a kind of ascertainment where you look generally at the population rather than in specific looking at kids with severe disabilities. So what we decided to do was to do a group of communities in the United States, one in the Midwest, one in the Rocky Mountains, one in the Pacific Southwest, and several communities in the Southeast of the United States to do more of a school-based estimate. Some of the communities did not want to be identified in the study, and others were fine, in fact, wanted to be identified because they thought it might lead to some changes in drinking behavior in the community. So Sioux Falls is actually the Midwestern community that was studied. And Sioux Falls was actually, I think, sort of the shining star of these studies because we had 100% participation of the elementary schools in the city. So all of the elementary schools in terms of the public schools, the Catholic schools, the Christian schools, there's one Lutheran school, they all participated. We had enthusiastic support of the superintendents and the principals. So what we did was we looked over a period of several years at all of the first graders in Sioux Falls. And we used two different methods of looking for this condition in the schools. The first method was the same we had used in other countries, which was any child who was less than the 25th percentile in height or weight or whose head circumference was less than the 25th percentile, those children were invited to participate in the study. The other way you could get into the study with that this first methodology was if the family requested that their child be evaluated or if the teachers requested that a child be evaluated. If any of those conditions were met, then the parents were contacted and were the child was invited to participate in the study. And so if the parents consented, then the children were included. We had an excellent consent rate. It varied somewhat around the city, but well over 70% of the children in Sioux Falls participated in the study. So what happened was all of the children who were in the study were evaluated by pediatric specialists like myself who have expertise in looking for the symptoms and signs of alcohol damage during pregnancy. All of them had a battery of neuropsychological tests, And then the mothers were interviewed about health in pregnancy and alcohol and medication use and so on. And then when all of that information was available, we had a case conference and the kids were discussed and diagnoses were assigned. You can imagine we picked up genetic diagnoses and other conditions other than FAS in these children as well. And then we met with the families afterwards to discuss the results of the study. So Sioux Falls, as I said, was actually one of the first communities that was looked at in the United States in this way. And we completed our part of the study several years ago now. San Diego is another one of the communities that did want to be identified. And obviously that's a huge city. So in order to evaluate the prevalence in schools in San Diego, they did a random sample of the schools rather than all of the schools participating. And then the other schools in the Rocky Mountain West and in the Southeast did not want to be identified, but the same methodology was used in those schools. The second way we looked at this was in one of the years, the kids were randomly selected, so there was no selection based on height, weight, head circumference, learning problems, anything of that type. There was just sort of a random selection of children in the schools, and they were evaluated in the same way. In each of those years, there was this control group that was looked at in the same way. So we looked at kids who had normal growth and development and so on as well. And the examiners were blinded to any exposure that might have happened in pregnancy. So when we were examining these kids, we didn't know who was a normal control and who was a child who had been selected because of either growth or developmental problems. So this methodology, which is active case ascertainment in population-based studies, is the best way to get a handle on how common any kind of health problem is. And so that's the way that the Centers for Disease Control and other agencies always evaluate the prevalence of any kind of health problems. So anyway, the data were finally completed. There were over 6,000 children who were evaluated in these studies in the United States. There were somewhere over 200 children in those studies who were affected. And so what the prevalence rate ended up being varied somewhat on the year in which the study was done and which community was queried, but the rate is somewhere between 2% and 5%. Now, there was another way of looking at the data, which was called weighted evaluation, and that was a statistical method of trying to determine if some of the patients who didn't consent to be in the study were actually affected. And those data showed a somewhat higher prevalence rate. Now, when we're talking about this, what we're talking about is really a whole spectrum of disability. On the one hand are children who have significant learning and behavior problems. They're usually quite small, have a small head circumference, and a distinctive appearance to the face. Those are the classic children with fetal alcohol syndrome. On the other end of the spectrum are children who have either cognitive deficits, that is, they have a lower IQ, or they have neurobehavioral problems, but don't really demonstrate the growth and the structural changes in the face seen in the other kids. But in this study, we picked up the whole spectrum. So this the kids who we identified then varied from the more severely affected kids to the mildly affected kids. So it took many years to complete, And it took a lot of man and woman power to get this completed, but it was finally completed and was just, as you say, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
So tell me, were there any surprises, do you think, for you?
Any surprises in the study? I think there were. I mean, what we discovered was something that some of us suspected, but that isn't generally known in the general population. And that was the fact that this condition does not respect socioeconomic status or racial background. So these kids were seen all across the socioeconomic strata of society. There were children whose parents were professionals, and there were children whose parents were unemployed. And so what the difference was drinking in pregnancy. It had nothing to do with socioeconomic background. And then the other thing that found that I think was important was that these children are generally not born to women who are alcoholic. These children tend to be born more commonly, and not only in the United States but around the world, in women who binge on weekends. And by binging, I mean five or more drinks in an evening. So these would be women who would go out with friends on Friday or Saturday night and drink maybe to the point of intoxication, but five or six drinks, and then repeat that every weekend. And what we found was that statistically, women who do this sort of binge weekend drinking tend to be less careful about birth control, and they tend, once they do get pregnant, to get later onset of prenatal care. So oftentimes these women would show up for their first prenatal visit at 12 weeks. Well, by that time, they've had 12 weekend binges, and that amount of drinking can do significant damage to the developing central nervous system. So as I said, this is a problem. It's binge drinking on weekends is a particular problem in the upper Midwest. North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin have some of the highest weekend binging rates in the United States. So I think it's important for women to realize that if you are going to be drinking and you're sexually active, you need to be on birth control. And if you're planning on becoming pregnant, you shouldn't be drinking. So I think that those would be the messages we'd like to get out.
And how does what you found in the United States compare to your other studies around the world, like in Africa?
The data that we have in the United States is very similar to what we see in Western Europe. So, for example, the studies we did in the Lazio region, which is the wine-growing region outside of Rome, showed very similar prevalence to what we saw in Sioux Falls. The one part of the world that has a much higher rate of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, which is what we call this whole continuum of disability, is South Africa. Particularly the western and the northern Cape regions of South Africa, these tend to be families who are farm workers, and the culture there has been one of heavy alcohol use on weekends for hundreds of years. And in those areas, the rate is somewhere between 10% and 20% of children in the schools are affected. So, as opposed to 2% to 5%, the rate is probably four times higher in South Africa. Now, not all countries have done this sort of analysis. The World Health Organization has been encouraging sort of an international look at this. But these studies take a long time. They need expertise from people who are very familiar with a whole range of disabilities in children, and they're expensive. And so some third world countries can't afford to have these kinds of studies done. But we have no reason to suspect that the biology of this is any different around the world. And so the one factor in common here is drinking during pregnancy.
So these kids that were part of the study were diagnosed on the spectrum. And so then what happens after that? So they probably received a diagnosis they may not have received. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes. In fact, I think out of the 222 children who were diagnosed, there were only a handful, less than 10, who had previously been diagnosed as having a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. There had been a study done in Chicago back in 2015 at Children's Hospital, and they showed that 80% of children who eventually have a diagnosis of a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder had gone most of their childhood without the diagnosis or had been misdiagnosed with something else. So, you know, I think one of our other take-home messages is how important it is for us to teach primary care physicians to recognize this condition. The American Academy of Pediatrics is and has made a major educational effort in this way, just as they've done with autism spectrum disorders. This continuum of disability due to alcohol exposure is at least as common as autism, and depending on the community, is more common. So, you know, this is a preventable condition. This is something that if women are careful and they're not drinking in pregnancy, this condition does not occur. So those of us who are in this field, after these data are available now, I think it's a real wake-up call to educate the general population, but also to educate physicians to be aware of this group of conditions.
You mentioned something that I want you to elaborate on just a little bit, and that is the misdiagnosis. So some kids could be, just a behavior disorder instead, but really they're on the FASD spectrum?
That's correct. Many times, you know, what we diagnose in pediatrics are descriptive conditions, we don't have a cause. So some of these children, for example, may have been diagnosed as having attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, although the neurobehavioral profile of that is actually quite different than fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. But it may be that many of these children have been carried as having that type of diagnosis, which doesn't really have a specific cause associated with it. Or there are children who, without genetic testing, have been sort of subjectively diagnosed as having genetic disorders. It's often the other way around. I've seen children who have been diagnosed as having a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder who, in fact, have a genetic disorder. And so it can happen either way, but misdiagnosis is very common in this group of conditions.
So now what happens to these kids who have been diagnosed through your study?
Well, I think that what the research has turned toward is twofold. One is prevention. What's the best way of teaching people, and women in particular, about the risk of drinking in pregnancy. And the other area of research is in intervention. We have are actually going to be publishing a paper soon, which will is based on a study that was done in South Africa looking at a large group of infants whose mothers drank in pregnancy. And those children were followed very carefully from birth up until the age of school, so 6 or 7 years of age, at which time they went through the same protocol that we just described in the study in the United States. And then we looked back at the characteristics of these children in infancy to see which behavioral or growth or structural characteristics in the infant were most predictive of the diagnosis being made at school age. The point is, if we can diagnose this disorder within the first few months of life rather than waiting until they're in school, then you can institute early intervention. And there are significant data not only with this disability but with others as well to indicate that early diagnosis and institution of early intervention in terms of occupational, speech, and physical therapy can lead to greatly improved outcome in the long run. So the latest push will really be in intervention. That is, what can we do both in the school and at home and medically with these kids to make sure that their outcome is improved? Now, you can't, this is a disorder that in terms of function primarily affects the brain. And the brain can't be fixed, but what you can do is, if this diagnosis is picked up early, the child can accommodate changes and learn to new techniques of learning and behavior, some biofeedback and so on, which can eventually lead to them having being much more successful in adulthood. You know, so I think our idea is to try to get the message out to physicians and families so that this can be diagnosed in infancy if possible, and then to institute early intervention so that in the long run the people with these conditions become the most productive members of society they can be as adults.
This has been your lifetime study, your lifetime passion. What's really next for you and with this topic?
Well, as you said, I've been doing this now for 37 or 38 years, and there are there's a lot left to be done. I continue to be active in the field. I was honored this year. Sanford Health named and gave a donation to a medical school in South Africa to called the Sanford Hoime Research Program in Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders. So this is at the University of Stellenbosch, which is one of the two major medical schools in Cape Town. And the point was to establish a research fund, which was an endowment, which would lead to in perpetuity, a way of funding research to try to bring down that incredibly high 10 to 20% rate of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in South Africa. So I was humbled and honored that Sanford Health did that, and that's an ongoing connection between Sanford Health and the University of Stellenbosch in this type of work. But I continue to go to South Africa usually once a year, and I participate in a number of research studies there. There's actually some data to indicate that some of the damage that's done by alcohol in pregnancy can be lessened by nutritional supplementation of the agents that can enhance brain development. So there's a big study going on looking at the addition of choline to the prenatal diet of women who've been identified as having drunk heavily in early pregnancy. And there's some preliminary data to suggest in animal models that even if the child has been, or in the experimental animal has been exposed to a significant amount of alcohol in early pregnancy, the outcome can be improved by having also been exposed to choline in gestation. So this is an ongoing area of importance, because this is the most common environmentally induced disability in the world. And as I said, it's preventable. And so what we would like to do is, you know, hopefully in another 30 years, not have to be talking about this group of conditions. So a lot of work left to be done.